found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for listening to us. We are live. It is Monday, July 29th at 9 o'clock Pacific. Thank you for joining us. Hope you had a fabulous weekend. We have on the program later today another homespun great news worthy. We try to focus on good news as much as possible. Organization that was started by two women who were active in hospice care and what they wanted to do and how to be more compassionate as people are transitioning from this life on this planet to what may be the hereafter. And we were fortunate enough to interview the two founders when they started, I'm going to say 5 or 6 years ago, and then it's morphed in the last 15 months to something else. So we'll be speaking with the executive director a little bit later on in the program, but we have an opportunity to get through some of the news that's pressing that's happened over the weekend. And this weekend, my family and I had what we euphemistically love to call a staycation. And this is the second full-fledged one that we've done. It involves like 72 hours. This time it had various permutations because all four of my children were with me at my home on Friday from like late afternoon until two of them left this morning. One of them left yesterday, and one of them left on Saturday late afternoon. So what we call a staycation is there's obviously five of us, and it's difficult to get five adult schedules to coordinate with people's work and constraints and finances and everything else. So we came up with the staycation concept, which is not new, really, other than the terming or wording of it, as in you're on vacation, but you're staying at home. So you treat yourselves like you might not ordinarily. You might, in our case, exercise less, eat more, indulge, including making desserts. As I mentioned all last week, I was my version of canning the white nectarines that had a bumper crop this year from the one tree that I have of that. And then I have a lemon tree, which also had a bumper crop, which I've been giving away lemons for forever. And so these peaches their nectarines are little. I can't even describe. They're like the shape of a ping pong ball, basically the size. But they're delicious. So I spent last week three different nights, first of all, picking, and the tree was planted on a side of a hill that's next to my home. So that's interesting. I had to get up on a ladder to get the fruit, then wash it, and then pit it, and then slice it. And then for every 4 cups of sliced fruit, I went from anywhere from a cup and all the way down to a half a cup of sugar, organic cinnamon. And then I simmered it on the stove for about 10 minutes, stirring frequently, cooled it down, and then bought these heavy-duty Ziploc freezer bags that I froze in 4 cup increments. And these ones now are something free of something plastic, which I try and pay attention to as much as possible. So I put that in the freezer. I think I did 36 cups of fruit. So on Wednesday night, a girlfriend asked me for dinner, and I made my first cobbler with it. And that was a huge hit, so much so that my girlfriend's husband asked if I would leave the rest for him, which he did. And then Friday night, I made it for my four children, and it was a huge hit also with them. I took the fruit and put it in the baking pan, and then I put a cobbler on top of it. It's basically butter, sugar, flour, and again, organic cinnamon, and roll it around and make little hunks and stuff like that and bake it. And it was fabulous. And we even had vanilla ice cream with it. So we had a decadent staycation. And then I made fudge on Saturday. And then yesterday, my second son, Alexander, made sugar cookies. So we finished the entire day in the weekend when debauchery and major calorie overload. And I was ready to go for a walk yesterday. And my son who went with me, Alexander, on Saturday was like, nope, this is my one day off. It's like, I don't usually take a day off. So I figure there's many days where I won't be able to walk. So every day that I can walk, I try and I hike basically. And he said to me as of yesterday that he was sore from our hike on Saturday. I'm like, yes, because he's a gym rat. He's my inspiration in life. I'm really trying to get him to do something to inspire others because he lost 175 pounds. Yes, that's 175. And he's told me he's about my height. So that's about 5'9". And I asked him for numbers finally on Saturday because I've never really pried. He said he got up to 340 pounds, and now he's about 180, sometimes 175, depending. And he did it with diet and exercise. No gimmicks, no surgeries, no, you know, fasting, no starving, no anything. And it took him roughly 2 years to achieve that. And his before and after pictures are staggering. In fact, my sons are huge fans of Reddit. R-E-D-D-I-T. I think it's a 20-something site. They told me to go on, and I went on once, and I could tell that it was definitely skewing to a younger demographic, but it still had world events on it. But he posted a before and after picture, and it went viral on Reddit, and people were like saying, no, he photoshopped it. No, you can tell this. No, you can tell that. And then Reddit took it down because he had posted it in the wrong place. Apparently there's a health and wellness place or something to post those pictures, and he didn't do that. So it went down. And so he was saying that he was thinking about doing a book, and I said he should. And he said, but I don't have anything special to say. Like, I did it the right way, diet and exercise, calories in, calories out. And I said, yes, but the fact that you did it, and you did it without gimmicks, and you did it without a personal trainer, and you did it without a nutritionist or a dietitian or drugs or anything, you know, intervention, lap band, whatever, is, I think, inspiring in and of itself, no less the before and the after pictures. Because he went from a triple X to a men's medium. I mean, I didn't ask him about his waist, what, you know, the pants went to, but so in any event, he's the one that made the sugar cookies last night. The other thing we did, I do not watch television, literally. I will watch the Super Bowl. I'll watch the Academy Awards. I will watch NFL games. I wish I had a team that I care about, but I don't. So I'll watch the playoffs. And if there's somebody in my life that really cares about a team, I like to adopt that person's team because at least I have a reason to care because there's somebody that I care about, that kind of thing. So consequently, I know about what's on in terms of feature films and on television because I read about it. We're in the news in terms of being topical and whatever, but I don't see it with my own eyes. Well, because my sons join me for dinner once a week, they have taken it upon them that they introduce me to various forms of television series and what's offered. So the first they did was Breaking Bad, and I got to see the first 4 seasons of that. They have withheld season 5 from me because they say it's not worthy. Season 6 apparently is debuting shortly, and when they get a couple of those episodes under their belt, they're going to decide whether or not they should let me watch season 5 before they expose me to season 6. Then we went to Downton Abbey, and we finished those 2 seasons, and I understand that the U.S. version is going to be available on my birthday, January 5th, but the U.K. version is available this fall, I guess. And I don't know how they're going to go about that. I don't know if you do it on Netflix or Redbox or whatever. And then now they've exposed me to Arrested Development, which I affectionately call AD for I call it AR for Arrested, which, of course, it should be AD. So I always manage to convolute things, and I don't do it deliberately, but so we finished season 2 and we started season 3 yesterday. And then I got my 2 sons who were left with me, who were still here as of yesterday, which was sons 2 and 3, Alexander and Christopher. Last night, about 7 o'clock, I said, do me a favor, because they were looking on their Netflix account to see what feature film they maybe. Oh, because we even saw the comedy of Louis C.K. We watched one of his stand-ups on Saturday, and that was fabulous. And there's comedy in the news, so that's going to be a nice tie-in. But So I love a good stand-up as well as the next person. And the irony is that I was married. My first husband, their father, was a stand-up comic that when we met, he actually was on a TV show that I didn't watch, that I didn't know. But he was a headliner in the comedy clubs. He used to open for Dionne Warwick and Joan Rivers. And he had quite the career until he was his own worst enemy. So I got them to watch last night Intouchables, which was a film that came out, I think it came out in 11. And it's a French film and it's subtitled and it's based on a true story, which is another reason that I love it because that's why I read nonfiction, not fiction. And I don't see feature films more than once. And I said to them, I will watch it. And they're like, no, not now. I was like, please just indulge me. It was 112 minutes. And they're like, it's going to be too sad. I said, no. And it was, I think, even better the second time around. I laughed just like I laughed the first time. Didn't expect it to be funny. Because if you've seen the trailers for Intouchables, it's about a quadriplegic and his caregiver and their relationship. So I figured it was going to be touching and poignant and inspirational. Well, it is that, and it's also funny. And the comedy hits you by surprise, so that's even better about that. So as long as we're talking about comedy, before we get into some of the hard news stories that unfolded late yesterday and this morning, it says, this is from Stanford University School of Medicine, according to a recent study, scientists actually found that women's brains show greater activity in response to humor than men's do. Thus, most women look for one thing in a partner, a sense of humor. It's even thought that women use a man's ability to make them laugh as a way to judge his genetic fitness as a suitable partner and maybe even a potential father. So Stanford University School of Medicine scanned the brains of girls and boys aged 6 to 13 who were watching funny videos. The females were more likely to show higher brain activity during viewing than the boys. Thus, in turn, women were more likely to take pleasure in the comedic activities. And the research believes that these findings could suggest that selecting a mate may be based on how well a woman finds her partner's jokes and overall humor. And I think we've seen this over and over again. They talk about men being visual and women being more cerebral and verbal, if you will. And what are one of the top three things that women look for in a mate? And it's a sense of humor. And I've married two funny men, and so I guess that's why this story appealed to me, because my first was a stand-up comic. My second ex-husband is a satirist and a comedic genius, and I was both of theirs number one fans. Their talent I was in awe of, and people are like, geez, you like funny. I was like, yeah, I guess that states the obvious. So here's a study that says why. And I've also heard from men that they appreciate a woman who has a sense of humor and her ability to laugh organically. And that if it's a forced laugh, it's a turnoff. And that's something that they pay attention to. So I remember when my second ex-husband and I went to our first lunch together, we were colleagues. And I had asked for the meeting because I thought he might be able to help mentor me. And because he had been in the talk radio business for, I don't know, at that time, at least 10 years. He's been in radio for 40 years now, so this shows you. We met about 16 years ago. So I thought that, you know, he might be able to help me out and give me some advice and stuff, because at the time I was doing fill-ins. I didn't have a regular show, and he knew the ropes and et cetera. And he said the first time I laughed, he could tell that it was something that I do often and that came naturally, and that was part of the appeal. So here I am, you know, having lunch with a colleague who I think maybe we had met in other words, he worked during the week and I worked on the weekends. I can't believe if we met in person, but I was part of a team back then, and my partner's the one that she said, why don't you ask him, because he seems like he's amenable. And I said, okay. And he said, I'm available only during the week. And she said, I'm only available on weekends. And she said to me, then you go ahead and meet with him and just let me know how it goes. And that's what we did. So we had a really nice talk. He's a nice man. I knew he had a girlfriend long distance, because he talked about that on his show. And I am the type of woman that if somebody has constraints, i.e. commitments, i.e. they're married, i.e. they're in a relationship, I have blinders on. And at that point, that person becomes neuter gender to me, that they don't, they're not a sexual object any longer. They're a human being. And so knowing that he had this long distance girlfriend, I said to him, maybe we could be buddies. You know, I've got some, since I was working on the weekends and one day during the week, I said, I have some time on my hands and maybe we could play nine holes of golf or go see a matinee or something. And he said to me later, he was saying to himself, I'm not going to be your buddy. I'm interested in you. But he didn't say that to me. So he walks me to my car. Keep in mind, it's like, you know, 1:30 on a Wednesday afternoon or something. And he says, how about a kiss? And I'm like, boundaries, I've said to myself. And I was like, oh, how about a hug? And so I put my arms around him and I patted him on the back. It was pretty maternal. And then he goes, and not a kiss. And I said, okay. And I kissed him on the cheek. Then I got back in my car and I'm like, boundaries, Maria, boundaries. So he then asked me out and I said to him, what about that girlfriend of yours? And he said, I would be willing to break up with her to see you. And I said, well, then you would need to do that, because I had seen a man prior to that who had asked me out several times. And when I called him at his place of work one day, one of his coworkers who answered the phone said, Maria, you need to know that Ron has a girlfriend. I said, well, when I met him, he said he did, because I figured most people do. But he said that she wasn't that important to him. And she said, you need to know that they're living together. And I was like, oh, okay, that's information I should have. And she said, and you need to know that they're engaged. And I was like, oh. So not only do you have a girlfriend, she's a live-in girlfriend. Eh, she's your fiance. So after that, I got real like clear on, no, I'm not, unless you're free and clear, I'm not interested. So he did indeed break up with his girlfriend, and we did indeed date, and we did indeed get married. And unfortunately, that marriage didn't last. I love the institution of marriage. I just haven't been good at making it last. Whereas one of my girlfriends says, your picker is broken. So as long as we're talking about matters of the heart, there's a new app out for 99 cents, and it's called the Breakup Text. And they're saying a texted breakup is largely de rigueur these days after Katy Perry revealed that Russell Brand had dumped her by text. And I remember in the olden days, when Sylvester Stallone dumped a fiance or a wife, I can't remember, Brigitte was her name, years ago, and he did it by sending her a FedEx note. I think he was in California and she was in New York at the time. And I was at the time was like so bloody cruel, amazingly cruel. And so now, of course, we break up by texts. I've been guilty of it and I've had it delivered it to me via text. In fact, as recently as over the weekend. And it's like, really, he raised some interesting points. We had just dated a couple times last weekend, and I thought that it was going well. He had been somebody that I dated a year ago, and he came back into my life through our Harley connection. We have a mutual girlfriend in common. And so he asked me out, and then he asked me out again the next night. And since I had not seen anybody, it was like, great. And then a week ago, Saturday night on our date, I asked him, would he like to come in? And he's like, sure. And that to me is normal, that you would invite somebody in if they want to come. And would you like a drink? Would you like some soda? Would you like some sparkling water? What? And he said he'd have a drink. And so we started kissing. And at one point I said to him, you know, I'm not getting intimate until I know where we're going and where we're headed and if you're interested in a relationship or not, because that's something that's required for me at this stage of my life. And he's like, are you ready for a relationship? And I said, I am. And he goes, I'm going to have to think about that. And he spun around on his heels and he walked out the door and was like, okay, cool. Glad that that's how it went. And if that's what he needs to do, then that's what he needs to do. That's what he's entitled to do. So that was a week ago Saturday. Never heard from him. And thought, well, okay, I've had this before too. Silence says it all. And my girlfriend's like, you know, men need time to process things. They can't do it as quickly as we can. I was like, whatever. Take all the time you want. So I sent him one text early in the week, because the last I had heard from him was, I'm going out on a ride, Harley ride. I'll call you when I get back. That was Sunday morning. So he didn't call. and then Monday came and went. And so I thought, you know what happens if I'm stewing and he's hurting? Like, he got hurt. So I sent him a text and I said, it just occurred to me that the last I heard from you was before your ride. So I'm just wanting to make sure that you arrive safely. He said, oh, I was just going to call you. I'm swamped. Yes, I did. And I was like, okay, cool. So that was Monday. So silence until Saturday, day before yesterday. And that's when he says, you know, when you asked me the question, it seemed odd and you invited me into the house without expectations of getting intimate. That's weird. And I don't see this happening. I was like, okay, good. Glad to know. Thanks for the text, dude. And I said, I don't think this is something that we should solve electronically, and that's all I've heard from him. So if you are a wussy and you can't do it in person or you can't do it on the phone, then you have an app now. It's called the Breakup Text app. It has a level of humor in it. You can choose to tell your ex that you were eaten by a bear, but it heightens the humor by also writing long, heartfelt messages that are supposed to elicit sympathy. So somebody, not me, entered in, he says, I paid 99 cents just to see for myself what this app would write to a serious and seriously controlling ex, an utterly fictitious ex, you understand. So what the data was that he put in, which is basically that, this is what it spit out. Hi, I know you expected to make it to our next anniversary. Maybe beyond, who knows? There was that one night we named our maybe babies. That was cute. You're cute. But it's over between us. We've drifted apart. It's not just your impotency. It really isn't. And no, this isn't about that girl at work. It's us. Ever hear the song Cape Canaveral by Connor Oberst? Of course you haven't. That was one of our issues. Anyways, we're like that. A poltergeist love, and I need an exorcism. So that was with a serious soon to be ex. Then he tried to discover what the app would write if the gal had been merely a casual love. And this is what the app delivered. Hi, there's plenty of fish in the sea, huh? I know it's a cliche, but there's truth in it. You never know who's coming up around the bend. See, after the last time we met up, I ran into my college professor. She was my favorite, just the smartest woman you've ever heard talk about the history of the French Revolution. Anyways, it turns out she recently divorced. Her husband left her for a library sciences professor. Long story short, we're in love. I know it seems sudden, but life is sudden like that, you know? Anyways, best of luck finding your fish. So there you have it for 99 cents. One of the breakup text creators, Jack Levine, explained that though this was all quite funny, it wasn't entirely. He said, as much as we did it as a joke, it has sort of captured a moment in time when tech is becoming more pervasive in our lives and our relationships. And then somebody wrote a post saying, this is the creators, said, this app isn't very good. My breakup texts are always a lot better. So there we've entered the electronic age of breaking up. So also in the romance department, first comes love, then comes a credit check. For many singles, bad credit can be a deal breaker, and 30% of women and 20% of men say they won't marry a person with a low credit score. So most folks said money management skills are just as important as looks when deciding whether someone is worth pursuing, and this is especially true for women. Nearly half of all female respondents ranked financial responsibility and financial compatibility as more important or just as important as career ambition, physical attraction, sex, and intimacy. This study was conducted by freecreditscore.com, and it asked 1,000 adults about their dating habits. Male respondents said financial savvy is just as important as physical attraction, slightly less important than sex and intimacy, and much more important than career ambition. 57% of men say that credit score plays into their dating decisions. 75% of women said they considered the numerical rating. So, of course, credit scores are based on payment history, amount owed, the types of credit you have, and the number of years that credit has been available to you. So having dated a man who I was actually engaged to, this is about 3.5 years ago, who we had a wonderful relationship. We really got along well. We had similar aspirations and goals and everything else. As we the more we dated, I realized that he had nothing. He was becoming dependent on me financially. And that was such a cold deal breaker for me. It was almost as if a light switch, you just, it was so unattractive, so not sexy, and so worrisome that I couldn't have any feelings for him anymore. And I said to him, look, I've got four children. If I'm supporting anybody, it's going to be my children. I don't want to be taken care of, but I certainly do not want to take care of a man. And he was like, oh, it's in a, you know, he was in his late 50s. It's like, dude, if you haven't gotten it together by now, I don't know what to tell you. And may he rest in peace. He just passed away in May. And I spoke with his daughter before the funeral, and I said to her, I hope you know that the reason that we're not seeing, didn't see each other or continue to see each other or get married had nothing to do with feelings. Your dad was just so irresponsible financially. She said, yes, Maria, it's always been that way. So roughly half of the survey respondents have talked about their credit score with a romantic interest, 39% discussing it during the first year of a relationship, and 21% bringing it up before committing to a relationship, and 19% comparing scores before moving in together. So it's called, there's a website for credit obsessed folks that you can go to find someone in your score range. Unfortunately, it's the self-reported scores, so it's hard to tell if somebody's telling the truth, but it's called creditscoredating.com. And here's a familiar quote from somebody that was surveyed that I've heard from men. I've run across many singles that are looking for someone to rescue them. This is a recipe for disaster. Everyone must be able to stand on their own two feet first, which I keep saying to my daughter, because she was like, she really is a reluctant student in college, and she doesn't want to be there, and she's only there because I'm, quote, making her, because I said I won't support her unless she's in school. And she says, I'm just going to marry a rich man. I said, Catherine, no, that's not going to solve anything. You need to have your own education, your own career, and your own money. It's the only way that you're going to be able to have two feet and stand on it firmly. Look at your mother. So Pope Francis is in the news today because he did a no-holds-barred, wide-ranging news conference on the papal plane that was taking him back today from Brazil to Rome. And he talked, he touched upon a bunch of topics, but the one he talked about gays, he talked about the Vatican Bank corruption, he talked about the role of women, he talked about abortion, his own personal security, divorce, and homosexuality, and that's what's making the news. He said today that he will not judge gays and lesbians, including gay priests, offering another sign that the new pope is committing to changing the church's approach to historically marginalized groups. Here is his quote. If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge? So today they're saying Pope, the man who is the James Martin, a Jesuit priest whose editor at America, a Catholic-based magazine in New York, said, today Pope Francis has once again lived out the gospel message of compassion for everyone. The Pope spoke on the record for an hour and a half in the back of the plane that was carrying him back to Italy after his first international trip as Pope to Brazil, where he was greeted by massive frenzy crowds at every turn. Yesterday, the mayor's office in Rio de Janeiro said more than 3 million people came to Copacabana Beach for the Sunday morning mass with Pope Francis. And they talked about his security. They raised the trip's security level to high risk when the Fiat made a wrong turn, and they sent in reinforcements to protect the Pope, who insisted on being close to the people. And so Pope Francis's quote about his personal security is, there is always the danger that there is the crazy person, and we never know what he or she will do. But to create a safety barrier between the bishop and its people is insane. And I'm outside the security. I prefer the risks of the madness outside to be closer to the people. He also carried his own bags. And they said, why did you do that? These are the reporters. And his quote is, it's normal. We have to be normal. We have to be accustomed to being normal. He spoke out about the role of women in the church, saying it needs to be deeper and not end, but he brushed aside the possibility of ordaining women as priests, saying the church had spoken on the matter. His quote, the church says no, that door is closed. But he did say that more work needs to be done theologically on the role of women in church. So he's really, really progressive, and I couldn't be happier because, as I've said before, I'm a practicing Roman Catholic, and I do have some serious differences of opinions with the church, one about women and their lack of involvement or ability to be involved, and also, too, about homosexuality. And finishing with talking about homosexuality, Pope Francis says, there's a lot of talk about the gay lobby, but I've never seen it on the Vatican ID card. When I meet a gay person, I have to distinguish between their being gay and being part of a lobby. If they accept the Lord and have goodwill, who am I to judge them? They shouldn't be marginalized. The tendency to homosexuality is not the problem. They're our brothers. So there is change in the Roman Catholic Church. Couldn't be better. So late yesterday, the driver of the Spanish high-speed train that was derailed was charged with 79 counts of homicide. He was released pending the trial. He appeared before a judge last night. Francisco Garzon, who's 52, had been under arrest since Thursday, a day after the worst train crash in Spain in decades. He is suspected of driving the train too fast through a tight curve on the northwestern Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela. Spain was to hold a memorial service today, is to hold it, for the 79 people who died, and that ceremony is taking place at 1 o'clock Eastern time, 10 o'clock Pacific time, in the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela, which is the world-famous pilgrimage city in northwestern Spain where the high-speed train derailed. And that's why folks were assembling, because they were celebrating the yearly festival of St. James, which occurs on July 25th. The week of concerts and other cultural events was canceled after the train crash on the eve of the festival. Yesterday, black ribbons of mourning hung on the empty stages that had been set up at the cathedral gates, along with flowers and candles commemorating the dead. Some people left walking sticks from their journeys, and others placed shells, the symbol of St. James, and badge of honor for the pilgrims who complete the journey. So they're investigating it. What's interesting is in the closed-door hearing, Garzon admitted taking the curve too fast. Some people say he took it at twice the speed, blaming it on a momentary lapse. Among conditions of his release, he was ordered to surrender his passport and check in regularly with the court. He has worked for Renfe for 30 years, 10 as a driver. His father also worked for the service and grew up in Renfe-owned housing in northwestern Spain. Now, the train they were in that was involved in the accident is one of three types of high-speed service that run in Spain. It received a full maintenance check on the morning of that journey, and the security systems were in good shape. The train runs both on traditional tracks where drivers must pay attention to the warning systems to reduce their speed, as well as on high-speed tracks where a more sophisticated security system will automatically slow down the trains that are going too fast. At the section of the track where the accident happened, it was up to the driver to respond to the prompts to slow down, thus not paying attention, didn't, and crashed. So may they rest in peace, and the vigil is just a half an hour away. So also in the news yesterday is something that, you know, talk about people making change. So here's this woman. She's a freelance journalist, broadcaster, and feminist campaigner. She's co-founder of the Women's Room, an organization that campaigns for more women experts in the media. She also started and ran the high-profile Keep Women on Banknotes campaign. Her name is Carolyn Criado Perez. So she was able to get the Bank of England to agree to picture Pride and Prejudice author Jane Austen on every 10-pound bill. So what happened yesterday? Abusive, sexually inappropriate tweets every hour towards her. And they finally arrested a 21-year-old man in Manchester yesterday. She was receiving about 50 sexually abusive tweets an hour. So Twitter's UK general manager, where this was taking place, said that the social networking company takes online abuse very seriously and offered to suspend accounts and called on people to report any violation of Twitter rules. But the UK Home Secretary Yvette Cooper wrote to him yesterday, criticizing Twitter's inadequate response. In her letter, she said, "Despite the scale and seriousness of these threats, the official response from Twitter continues to be extremely weak. Simply directing Caroline away from Twitter towards the police and belatedly directing users to abuse reporting forms on Twitter." So there's been more than 50,000 people signing an online petition urging Twitter to tackle internet trolls. And this has all just come about in the last 24 hours. The BBC's technology correspondent says that Twitter now faces a tricky dilemma of protecting free speech while under pressure to make the network a safer and more polite place. Twitter has already introduced a report tweet function for the iPhone and is currently developing the option for the web and Android. So this woman, who she's a fairly young gal, who was able to get the British government to put a woman on a banknote, has sparked outrage, and they're calling it in the global media and among the Twitterati. So the debacle has led to a campaign for a Twitter boycott on August 4th. It'll be interesting to see if this is followed up on. August 4th is International Friendship Day, and there's an e-petition for a report abuse button on tweets. So author of How to Be a Woman and columnist for The Times, Caitlin Moran, proposed a trolloday where Twitter users would tweet the holding message, waiting for troll solution. So we'll follow that story, but good luck and congratulations to this Caroline Criado Perez for doing what she does best, which is shaking things up. And now we'd like to call Ann Sobel, who's the executive director of our community, House of Hope, and what it is that they're doing regarding active hospice care.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning, Ann Sobel. This is Maria Sanchez. You're live and on the program. Thank you for joining us this morning. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine, thanks.
Good. I'm so glad that you contacted us, because our community House of Hope is exactly the kind of things that we like to highlight. One, because it's inspirational. Two, because you're providing something that hasn't really existed. Three, because you're local. And four, because you're making it happen. So it's a template for other communities to do it if they haven't done it already. So it's like, yes, we have good news in spite of the fact of the clients that you treat. So if you don't mind giving us the backstory, because I actually had the pleasure of interviewing Teresa when she was first starting the concept, which was about 5 or 6 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
And then it's morphed into something else. So why don't you go backwards with us, please?
Okay, sure. We are a home for the terminally ill that are in the last few weeks and months of life. The happiness you hear in my voice is that it is an opportunity for people to come to a home away from home, allow family members to be family members, and not have to be full-time caregivers and worried about how to give the medications or bathe the individual and all that. And we have a home that actually provides the dignity needed for people to be able to have a peaceful death. And we're just happy to do it. It started 7 years ago with Teresa Wolf and Ruth Klein as our founders. And we just opened 15 months ago. And in that time, we've had 32 people come to the home. And we have had just remarkable, remarkable growth and living before dying in the home.
It's so
phenomenal.
Hospice is about giving end-of-life care to a loved one in their own home. Is that correct in general?
In general, yes. A medical hospice does that, and we partner with medical hospices so that each of our residents has a medical hospice that consists of a team of people that's physicians and RNs and LVNs and home health aides. But what we provide, what our Community House of Hope provides beyond that medical hospice, is all of the social and the 24-hour caregiving. And we do that at no charge for these people.
So you actually have a home that's a standalone that they come to, that they live in. Okay, so that's what the difference is. And dealing with my dad, who's been bedridden because of a spiral femur fracture, and seeing the dynamics that go on with my mother being the primary caregiver and physically unable to actually get him in and out of bed and stuff, so then they have caretakers come in. I have a brief glimpse about what that looks like, but he isn't at an end-of-life stage. So I would imagine that it gets even more dramatic with the dynamics involved in terms of the care itself, the caregiver syndrome that I've heard about, also the fact that a family isn't nearby or can't afford the luxury of having somebody do what they could or want or should be doing. Our community House of Hope takes those situations and takes it on.
Exactly. And really what we're doing is we're allowing, if there is family close by, we're allowing family to be family. When you take on the caregiver role, the stress level changes dramatically. The feelings of worry and responsibility become greater. And the focus is all about the physical caregiving of that individual. And it becomes very hard to be the loving family member that you were meant to be, whether it be the child to the parent, or brother to brother, that kind of thing. And so by coming to our Community House of Hope, people have the opportunity to live in a home, in a home-like environment, and the caregivers who are also family members get to come back to being family members.
Mm-hmm. I can see
and
that.
And helping that person.
So, Anne, how does somebody get considered to be able to avail themselves of your services?
Well, they have to, unfortunately, be diagnosed to have a terminal illness, and they're in their last couple months. Nobody knows for certain. That can always change, but they need to be in their last couple of months of the illness. They have nobody else that is able to care for them in a way that would meet all of their needs. Those are the primary criteria that we have. And if they don't, have money to go someplace else, then that's always something that we consider too. But it isn't about whether people have money as much as do they have someone capable to care for them. We had an older gentleman who was 100 and came to us, and his youngest son, who was in his 70s, was his caregiver, and he himself was ill. And so we were able to relieve that son to be able to take care of himself, and then we were able to do the caregiving for Dad. So we look for situations like that where we can be very helpful to not just the person that's ill, but also the family.
And what's the capacity of your facility?
We have 4 beds. Everybody has a private bedroom, and so we only have 4. Our desire is to grow to an 8 to 10 bed facility. A couple weeks ago, we had 16 people on a waiting list.
Aye.
And the need is there. The need is there. And so our dream is to be able to get a larger facility to be able to serve more people.
And you're in a residential home.
We are. We're in Thousand Oaks. We have it's a leased facility. If a person is still able to be a little ambulatory, say in a wheelchair or even with a walker, we'll take them to the kitchen and we'll have a group meal. The staff that meet with them, or family can come. We have a beautiful backyard that is just a real nice garden environment, so people can go out there and sit at the sun. It's not something where people are in their room and that's just where they stay. If they have the desire and the ability, we get them out into the home and enjoy the home as if it's theirs.
And how do you foresee expanding, almost more than doubling? It would be another facility?
It would have to be another facility. It might be something like in just being here in Southern California, I think it probably will end up being some building that we can remodel, rehab.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all going to come from the community. We are not licensed to bill Medicare. Medicare does not pay for these types of services. We are free to the residents. We're funded 100% by community donations. So the new facility to meet the need is going to come from the community in some fashion.
So do you do partner with hospice then?
We do. Mm-hmm. Medical hospices, yeah.
And so because you're free to clients and you have trained folks there 24 hours a day, I'm assuming your costs are fairly significant.
They are. They are. Our staff are not paid well, but they are dedicated to serving those in their end days, and so they look at it as a calling. But yes, we have a lot of volunteers that come in and help, but we do have lead staff that are there to be able to oversee what's going on and services and care. So yeah, our expenses are up there. But we have an operating budget of about $300,000 a year.
So 7 years ago when Teresa and Ruth were launching the concept to 15 months ago when you actually opened your doors, what went on in that interim? Was that all about fundraising and adhering to legislation?
It was about telling the community and making sure that the community would support. And
did we lose her? I think we did. Ronnie, if you don't mind calling her back, because it sounded like our connection was, thank you. So we're talking with Ann Sobel, who is the executive director of our community, House of Hope, that's located in Thousand Oaks. Free to clients, and they're funded by donations only, so we'll find out how we can help out. She might not know that we dropped off.
Hello?
Hi, Ann. We lost the connection, so we called you back.
I am very sorry.
No worries.
And I'm on a landline. That's what just happened.
Go figure. So last we heard, it's okay, is that in the interim between Teresa and Ruth's creation of the concept 7 years ago to the 15 months ago when you actually opened your doors, you went through all the process, I would imagine, the legality of it, and then also you had to start the funding of it in order to find a place to identify, to configure it, to be able to do what it is that you're doing.
Yes.
So how can we help?
Well, first of all, there's two things. One is have the conversation with your family about what your desires are about your end-of-life care. It's more than having all of your paperwork and the business side of life taken care of with trusts or whatever is applicable to your situation. But have you really talked to your family? Have you talked to your kids? I really would like this. I don't mind going in a nursing home. That's fine. Or I want to be home as long as I can. But if you can't take care of me, I understand if I need to go to someplace like our community House of Hope. One of our goals is to demystify death. And the more we talk about it, the more commonplace it will be that people will understand. And when the time comes that we have to care for a loved one, they can better know that they're doing what that loved one wants. And then the second thing, obviously, is to support our community House of Hope. We want to be a replicable model. We want to see more of these homes opened throughout Ventura County, Los Angeles, and even in other states. We believe that with the aging population, the need is only going to grow dramatically. Mm-hmm. And we just really need to be sure that we have places for people to go that may not choose a hospital or a nursing home, that they would like to live in a home environment, but living in their own home just isn't practical.
So how daunting is it? Because that's what I like about this, Ann, is that it is replicable, if I can say that right, to other communities. I mean, did you have to have someone guide you through the labyrinth of how you're going to be able to open your doors?
Well, we've been blessed to have a sister organization in Tulsa, Oklahoma called Clare House, and one in Cleveland, Ohio called Malachy House.
There you go.
They were able to guide us through the process and
nice.
And conceptualize. And so we want to do that for others. It's not about building our community House of Hope to have 25 homes across the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's not our vision. Our vision is to serve people and help others build their own home so each community can support their own home.
Nice.
Yeah.
What web address would you like to share?
I appreciate the time that people give to our community House of Hope. And if you could go to www.ourhouseofhope.org, if you'd like to donate, you can donate there.
Excellent. So when we post the podcast later today, we will put that contact information there for our listeners. And then feel free to link this to wherever, because it's the perfect example of how we all can make a difference in the world and ideas can become realities. And Anne, who is a philanthropist and a social worker at heart, has helped so many organizations. I can't thank you enough for what you do for our world, Anne.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I love helping people.
I know you do. Ann Sobel, thank you, Executive Director of our Community House of Hope. This is Maria Sanchez wishing you the very best of Mondays, and we look forward to visiting with you mañana. Thank you for joining us.
Sanchez.